The lesson for today is Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23. Let us hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who has promised is faithful. Word of God, word of life. Thanks be to God.
This morning, we will be receiving the message from three very different perspectives. Kate Beckerman has been attending First United Methodist Church since she was 5 years old, but her Santa Monica Methodist heritage runs very deep, as her great-grandmother, Ruth Heppner, and grandmother, Heidi Crooks, have been longtime members. Kate is in sixth grade at the Archer School for Girls. She's a competitive swimmer, plays basketball, sings, and plays the viola. Her favorite school subjects are history and English, and she would like to go into teaching. Maddie Ng has grown up as an active member of Santa Monica First United Methodist Church and views this as her other family. Maddie is a recent graduate of Cal Berkeley, where she majored in molecular cell biology and linguistics. She is currently spending her time as a medical scribe at the Curlin Job Orthopedic Medical Group, while busily sending out medical school applications to pursue her dream of becoming a doctor. Michael Olson also attended sixth grade in college, but a few years before Kate and Maddie. Michael is a lifelong Methodist, a 40-year member of the Santa Monica First United Methodist Church. He's retired following a 30-plus year career in various administrative positions at UCLA. He's currently participating in the Upper Room's 2-year Academy for Spiritual Formation. While he enjoys yoga, reading, and cooking, his greatest joy is spending time with his two sons, Kurt and Grant, and their respective partners. I know that we are blessed by their witness and by their faith this morning.
Hello, my name is Kate Beckerman. I'm 11 years old and in the sixth grade at the Archer School for Girls. I'd like to talk to you today about God's hope and what the phrase means to me. To love God, to believe in yourself, and to treat others with kindness and respect. This is not always easy. It is hard to always be your best self in trying to please God, to forgive when you are angry, or to share with others when you want something for yourself. It requires more than just words of faith or commitment. You have to think it, feel it, and show it. Sometimes I succeed at this, listening to my friends, showing sportsmanship and respecting my teachers. And sometimes I fail, not always respecting the opinions of others, losing my temper when I shouldn't, and being mean to my sister. But God's hope includes the struggle to live by His word and to learn from the times you do not. I find God's hope in music, in particular my involvement in the National Children's Chorus. The National Children's Chorus changes the lives of young people, including my own, by leading them towards the values of artistic brilliance, cultural openness, and social justice. We learn music, explore new cultures, and meet new people. We travel all around the world. With the NCC, I have sung throughout Italy, and in Berlin, Prague, Vienna, and Budapest. This upcoming year, we will visit Hiroshima and other cities in Japan and Seoul in South Korea. We share God's gift of music and try to bring God's hope to others. For as God said in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 30, those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Thank you.
feel like I can't see everyone, and maybe I should actually use this book. I wasn't planning to. Okay. Hi. Hello. Okay. Hello. Good morning, everyone. Before I start, I want to say thank you to all the youth sitting up there in their pajamas who we woke up very early this morning to get breakfast with us. Sorry, I'm not wearing my pajamas anymore. So, as Michael described earlier, my name is Madeline Ng, and I just graduated from college. As many of you may have experienced, college is just brimming with hope. College students tend to be young, we're really full of energy, learning often for the first time how to grapple with all of the isms of the world. There's racism, and sexism, capitalism, communism, environmentalism, so many more. Some of these isms are bad, some of them are good, some of them depend on one's own personal perspective, but they're all massive, nationwide, worldwide, social conventions or movements that subconsciously undermine many, if not most, daily human interactions. This ubiquity, the fact that these movements affect every part of our lives, means that when we as a society want to overcome a negative ism, like sexism or racism, we have to rewire every human being in that society. Totally impossible task, right? Maybe a hopeless cause, even. In college, it didn't seem so hopeless. Sure, it was an uphill battle. It was a difficult fight, but we talked about it all the time. In classes, joining student organizations, chatting in dorm rooms, or being flyered on the street. The whole job of being a student is to think about your place in the world, to analyze and reflect and philosophize. And so we gain the skills to discuss these weighty issues and begin to overcome them by thinking carefully about our interactions and about group dynamics. I became hyper-vigilant, thinking through every comment and impulse that I had, considering all possible responses from all different perspectives in an effort to respect those around me and do no harm in my best possible way. Now, this may seem like a huge burden to bear, but it didn't really feel like that to me because everyone around me was fighting the good fight. People were speaking intentionally, avoiding stereotypes, confronting problematic behaviors, and taking the time to reflect on privilege. These behaviors were normalized in my environment, and so they became normalized in my approach to the world. And I felt so extremely hopeful. For our future as a nation, for the human race, because I was part of an army of well-trained soldiers fighting for compassion and human dignity. On graduation day, I knew in my bones that we as a class had grown and changed together into better people who are going to change the world. And after graduation, I moved home, out of the college bubble, into the real world. I had a plan, and I followed it, got a job as a medical scribe, applied to medical school, well, still applying. Everything still on track to change the world. But somewhere between the exhaustion of a 40-hour work week and the suburban streets empty of flyers and protests, I've lost a little steam. In this real world, I have more pressing priorities than to sit around and ponder the isms. And the people I interact with now have their own priorities too. Like doing a good job at work or taking care of a family. The behaviors I've normalized to deal with these big, scary structural issues the ones formed by a group of optimistic 20-year-olds, the ones that I think we need to change the world, they're not normalized here in my home environment. I remember a moment from my cousin's wedding. I was chatting with some distant family member, and the discussion circled around to race. He said something to the effect of, "Well, it was probably the black guy." I began to fight back. "Well, you don't know his situation. You don't know how he grew up. It's not fair to assume." And he just started laughing. And he said, "Oh, I know, I know. I went to college too, I'm sorry. You'll be jaded like me someday." The way he put it, he used to be like me. He used to be optimistic. He used to fight stereotypes. He used to be hopeful. The real world beat it out of him. I think we can all relate to this. Even if you didn't go to college, even if you're not a special little snowflake like I became, we've all had some moment, some group, some environment in which you felt like you were at the top of your game. You are fully equipped and fully capable of making a real difference. Maybe like me, you felt like you learned so much that it's just brimming out of you. And you can't wait to use those awesome skills on the rest of the world. But then, when you step into the part of the world that needs changing, it's suddenly really hard. Outside of that moment, or that group, or that environment, it's lonelier. There are other important things going on to distract you, and the tests of your abilities are way more difficult. Because people just don't get it, and no one thanks you for it. Because these people are mean and selfish, and they don't even want to be better, so why am I even still trying? Why am I still trying? Because God calls us to be the hope. Because once you see that things are wrong, you can't go backwards. You have to do something. Otherwise, you're part of the problem, letting negative behaviors slip by and continue to hurt more people. If you see something is wrong, you have to try and fix it. Or someone else gets hurt. It's that simple. Even if that something wrong is a seemingly insurmountable issue, like racism, and you seem to be the only one that can see it. So I pledge to be the hope. I promise to do my best every day, with every word and every action, to respect others, to do no harm, keep learning how to do better. Just those three things. I know I'm going to fail. I'm not perfect. I'll make mistakes, and things are not going to change overnight. But I'm not the only foot soldier out there. We all have the capacity to change the lives around us with a little bit of reflection and compassion. We all share the responsibility to be the hope.
Good morning. I'd like to thank Kate and Madeline for their heartfelt words and even more the inspirational lives that they lead. It's a great honor to be up here with them. It's also a little disconcerting when, you know, this is presented as generational messages, and there's got to be three or four or five or maybe even more generations between me and them. But I'm gonna give it a shot. So, given that I've been around a little longer than they have, I've taken a few lumps in life, as happens. And so when Michael called to ask if I wanted to speak this morning, and I asked him what the theme was, and he said, "Be the hope." I have to admit I had to think about that for a while. And then just by chance, in my reading, a few evenings after he made the call, I ran across a quote from the English writer G.K. Chesterton, who in his time was known as the Prince of Paradox. And since I like paradox a lot, I thought I'd share that with you. Here are his words. "Hope is the power of being cheerful in circumstances we know to be desperate." I'll try that again. "Hope is the power of being cheerful in circumstances we know to be desperate." Well, you know, that's a little bleak, I think. And so I went searching for other wisdom on hope, and oddly enough, I found it in the words of the late comedian Bob Hope. Really? On his deathbed, Mr. Hope's wife, Dolores, asked him where he wished to be buried. And in his very last words in this life, he said, "Surprise me." Well, and since I had Mr. Hope there anyway, I ran across another thing that he said. He said, "I have seen what a laugh can do. It can transform almost unbearable tears into something bearable, even hopeful." So, you know, what is this thing that we call hope? You know, sometimes it gets used selfishly, as in, "I hope I get a pony for Christmas." But, you know, maybe there is something better or different to it. Listen to the Apostle Paul from the fifth chapter of his letter to the Christians in Rome. "We also boast in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And hope does not disappoint us, as God's love has been poured into our hearts." Is there then this progression where hope is one of the stages or places that takes us to love? Is there a road to life with hope as one step on the way? So a road trip comes to mind, and for those of you who are old enough to remember, this is not one of those Bob Hope, Bing Crosby times. This is something else. And this comes from the story of Moses and his people's journey from the oppression under Pharaoh, crossing the Red Sea and spending 40 years in the wilderness searching for the promised land. And at the end of that seeking, hear these words from Deuteronomy chapter 34. "Then Moses went up from the plain of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him the whole land, Gilead as far as Dan, all of Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all of the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negev and the plain, that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. The Lord said to him, "This is the land I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there." Then Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there at the Lord's command. This story really haunts me. Moses, who is reluctant and scared and unsure so often, still he obeys God. And yet, in his end, God only gives him this glimpse of the promised land. What sort of God is this to only let us see, but not to let us get there? Let me make this a little more personal. Last February, I traveled with some members of our congregation on a mission trip to do some construction work in the village of Sobier. It was really a trip of wonder and deep meaning and wonderful connection with all the people who were on the trip, as well as so many of the people that we met there. Still, the sites that we saw, the destruction from the 2010 earthquake and then the more recent hurricane that had devastated Haiti, the struggles of the people, struggles that I saw everywhere, the enormous challenge of trying to overcome the pain and the poverty and the corruption that had existed in Haiti for centuries. And I had to admit to myself that at the end of each day, I was quite stunned by all of that. And I had to settle myself and give thanks for what we had done and also pray for myself for the next day, because I would see things equally hard, if not even harder. So in considering our theme for today of Be the Hope, I came to realize, at least for myself, that maybe it's more than about hope, and that I went to the beginning of it. I went to the be part. This is the question that I think so many of us wrestle with, and we find it everywhere in art and literature and in our own hearts. Shakespeare's Hamlet, poor, confused Hamlet, to be or not to be, that is the question. Are we to be, to live through that pain, to live through the endurance and the suffering, and the hope, and the love, or not to be? Do we choose death, even as we're alive, of keeping things at a distance because we're afraid of them? Is it just too hard? Sometimes for me it has been. And so we move along in life. I know of the struggles of some of you here, my friends. I've known my own. Yet, here we are, together, in this place. I'm convinced that we're not simply waiting for something to happen. Yes, sometimes we do have to wait, and wait, and wait. And that waiting seems like it will go on forever. But it's what we must do. The Spirit does come. Maybe not all the time. Maybe when we're at our lowest. Or maybe it comes on a beautiful day when there seems to be joy all around. We never know, but yet we trust. What am I to be? What are we to be? It's unknown and unknowable. As we start off in life and maybe as we go on through to the end. Maybe we live in our own promised land every day. Maybe we never actually get to see it. We simply need to be. And I think God says to us, surprise me. Thank you.